From Oregon to Wisconsin, Illinois to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, vinyl records and compact discs reappeared under many Christmas trees this year. It seems everything old is new again. Adam Thier from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to talk about the new trends. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has effectively killed the Build Back Biden bill, at least for now. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. We've heard of many strange government regulations, but Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks about a weird parking mandate imposed by a Texas city with Tori Clark from the Institute for Justice. And on this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says, like the song, we should celebrate Christmas for 12 days. I'm Loman Henry. Merry Christmas and welcome to American Radio Journal. Digital music still rules, but the soft sounds produced by vinyl records and the clarity of compact discs has many turning to those media when relaxing to the sound of music. Adam Thier is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He is author of the book, Invasive Entrepreneurs and the Future of Governance. He joins us now to talk about the resurgence of these formats. Adam, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Adam, we have seen in recent years, that a number of media that had once been very popular, fallen out of popularity, now resurging. Tell us a bit about what is happening and why are we seeing old media becoming new again?
Yeah, there's been an amazing resurgence of older, what I call analog era media products that we thought were long dead. These were things that existed before the internet, such as broadcast television, record players and record vinyl records, and of course, traditional print books. But amazingly, and much to everyone's surprise, including my own, they've experienced a surprising rebirth in recent years. And we see them becoming more successful than they have been in many, many decades.
It's interesting, Adam. I saw a television commercial not too long ago where they were pitching this remarkable new innovation that allowed you to get television for free. And it was essentially rabbit ears. Is there a whole new generation that's going to be susceptible to that type of marketing, that now you can get television for free when you always could?
Yes, that's a great point, because even my own children have been mystified by this technology we call rabbit ear antennas that can magically get you signals from far away. In fact, when I first showed my teenage daughter a broadcast television antenna and plugged it into a television to get a signal, her first question was, is this legal? She didn't understand how it was able to pick up a free signal from far away. It still is in many ways a magical technology that we can use antennas to pick up a distant signal from a radio or a broadcast television channel and station. That is something that a lot of people are bringing back into their homes and lives today, because it helps them cut their overall media budget, maybe even cut the cord with cable altogether and supplement whatever internet viewing they're doing.
All these streaming services that are available now, Adam, have you seen those adding to the desire to have this antenna, that now you can have a streaming service to get whatever series or movie you want and stick your antenna out there? You get your local channels too. Is it all working in a sort of symbiotic relationship?
That's exactly right. A lot of people love their streaming services, but after a while they can get expensive. And then there are certain types of content that they just can't give you, including things like local news or local sports. And so that's where utilizing an old-fashioned rabbit ear antenna to get a distant television signal makes a whole lot of sense, regardless of how old you are. And for a lot of people, including me, who had sort of boxed up their antennas years ago, we're pulling them back out of the attic or basement and reinstalling them again to pick up those signals once again.
Speaking of things that we boxed up years ago, a lot of us boxed up our old vinyl record albums or 45s. And now folks are starting to buy vinyl again. Is there a reason? Is there a quality to it that folks are finding appealing now?
Yeah, vinyl is red hot. In fact, from this year compared to last, it's up 94% in terms of sales compared to last year. And record stores just can't keep up with the surging demand. Vinyl is now topping CD sales for the first time since the mid-80s. And this is despite the fact that vinyl was actually pretty expensive. It's like $30 for a lot of new albums today. And yet people want that physical connection with the art forms they love, especially music. And a lot of younger kids came to appreciate vinyl's properties because it finally gave them a way to sort of show off the things that they love to their friends and family. And you can't do that with a digital media stream, right? And so physicality still matters sometimes to media, even if it's true that new digital music services are terrific. Old vinyl ones proving to be pretty great themselves.
Was it a mistake, Adam, for me to throw away my 8-tracks?
I think we're safe to say that some old technologies really are dead technologies. And I think you're probably worse safe to throw away your 8-tracks. There are still some people who do collect old cassettes, but 8-tracks not usually in the mix. But those were never really great technologies. They were good portable technologies for their time, but digital really has completely supplanted that market. Whereas vinyl is something that you have in your home or your dorm or whatever to basically show off to people and to sort of hold in your hands or to put it on a shelf. So I think each of these things plays a role, but yes, indeed, some older technologies like 8-track, probably dead and buried.
Speaking of things that you can hold in your hand and then put on a shelf, I was one who was never able to get into the whole digital book thing. I always wanted that actual book in my hand, and when I was done, I wanted to see it on the shelf. Are we seeing people wanting to do that more and more as well?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I, like you, did not give up my ginormous book collection. I kept all my physical books, but I was predicting 20 years ago that there'd be a time when I would give them up, and many other people would, to go all digital. That hasn't happened either. In fact, printed books enjoyed their largest annual increase in sales last year, up 8.25% over 2005. And the overall number of books sold was at its highest since 2009, which was the year before ebooks really started to become a meaningful part of the book publishing business. And so, again, the physical medium matters. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that people like to have a bookshelf and, again, like their records, show off their books. In other cases, it's just something you prefer the feel of. You like having a book in your hands instead of some sort of a computer screen or an ebook reader. Of course, you can live in both worlds, and many of us do, and you can even enjoy books via Audible or other sort of like book reading services, and those are great. So I think we have in many ways the best of all worlds when it comes to books. You can go old, you can go new, you can go with hybrid models, but the bottom line is the old media formats did not go away, and the old pundits like me who predicted the end of books, we were just flat wrong.
And a good thing that you were flat wrong, because you have actually written a couple of books in addition to reading them. Tell us, Adam, a little bit about the two current books that you have in circulation.
Yeah, thanks. I've written two books recently, one called Permissionless Innovation and another called Evasive Entrepreneurs. And what my books do is try to grapple with the really interesting public policy issues surrounding new and emerging technologies. And what I attempt to do is provide a framework for allowing for greater freedom and experimentation with these new technologies before we take a sort of a heavy-handed approach to regulating them. And that's especially the case because of what I've learned from the history of media and what we just talked about. It's really, really tough to predict the future course of technology. And sometimes what's old is new again, and therefore we should be very cautious about regulators coming in and trying to predict the future through some sort of a technological crystal ball. It's better to let that future unfold spontaneously and more freely.
And Adam, you are a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. So tell us a little bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, folks want to learn more about this, read your articles, read your books. Where can they find you on the web?
Yeah, come visit my page at mercatus.org. And at mercatus.org, you can find out a lot of wonderful information about different public policy issues. There you will find not only my books, including some free excerpts from them, but a lot of other articles on all of these various media policy issues. We at Mercatus try to advocate sort of market-oriented solutions to really challenging public policy issues, and we do this in conjunction with a lot of our partners at George Mason University.
Adam Thier from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Adam, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He kept an eye on all the legislative activity or inactivity, as the case may be, in the weeks leading up to Christmas. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Well, it is Christmas time, and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer had promised to get Build Back Better done by Christmas. Joe Manchin, well, I guess in a way it is done. Can you fill us in?
Yeah, well, obviously we've been dealing with the 50-50 Senate all year. That's the longest we've had a 50-50 Senate. And what that means is any senator can raise objections to stall an agenda. And this week, Joe Manchin went on Fox News and said that he was adamantly opposed to Joe Biden's social spending and climate package. And we all know it's the Build Back Better Act. And with him raising these firm objections and saying that he won't vote for final passage on any of those bills, it's really created quite the dilemma here in Washington for not just Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi as they navigate the moderates and the progressives on Capitol Hill, but what it means for Joe Biden and whether or not only 11 months into his presidency is he already a lame duck president.
Taking a look at this so-called Build Back Better bill, Scott, we did have just a few weeks ago passage of the so-called infrastructure bill. Was this just a case of where the cost just got too much for Joe Manchin to swallow? And I assume he's not the only senator, although he's certainly been the one who's taken the brunt of the controversy on it, who had to, on the Democrat side, who had to have some questions about it.
Yeah, you know, Joe Manchin wanted to increase taxes to pay for any of the social spending and climate initiatives that the Democrats wanted to enact. And that becomes a real parochial issue for senators from even states like California and New York, where there's a lot of big tech corporations or other financial corporations that would bear the brunt of those tax increases. Obviously, tax increases on corporations are ultimately passed down to consumers. And when you're seeing inflationary effect on the economy from the high level of spending that we've had in response to the coronavirus pandemic, we know that Joe Biden enacted $1.9 trillion of spending with his stimulus plan last March. You've also got that $1.2 trillion infrastructure package that was signed into law. And so when folks looked at another massive spending plan, Manchin said, hey, this has got to be paid for. You can't have budget gimmicks. And one thing that the bill did was it sunset, meaning it allowed for various programs within the legislation to expire on an earlier time frame so that there wouldn't be a full 10-year cost estimate for various provisions like the child tax credit extensions and whether or not you're going to be paying for child care, tax credits, things like that. And so Manchin asked for a real 10-year score, and we knew that would have added over $3 trillion to the deficit. The bill was not fully paid for. And so Manchin said, I'm going to be an adamant no. And the result on that has obviously been a lot of backlash from the progressive left. You've got Hollywood elitists like Bette Midler saying that Joe Manchin just wants the United States to be like West Virginia. And she said, quote, poor, illiterate, and strung out. Now, if that's your strategy to get Joe Manchin to come back to the negotiating table, I'm not sure that you know how to negotiate. So I think Hollywood elitists are beginning to lash out with what the Democratic majority in a 50-50 Senate with only the tiebreaker Kamala Harris can actually get accomplished. And the other thing that's sort of out there is the ability, the filing deadline in the state of New York has not approached yet. And so Chuck Schumer is feeling the heat in his own state from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who still might jump into that Senate race.
That would certainly be a Senate race to watch. But one of the things I find interesting here, Scott, is the president and others have bemoaned the fact that, quote, one senator is responsible for the demise, at least temporarily, of Build Back Better. But it isn't really one senator, is it? Republicans, somewhat unusually, have held together all 50 of them on this. So really, aren't there 51 votes in opposition?
There are. With reconciliation, it was always intended to be a blue team exercise without getting any Republican support. And that just shows how hard it is to keep all of your ideological elements of a Democratic caucus together in supporting a major element of the Biden agenda. So with Joe Manchin's opposition and also with all those Senate Republicans out there, you've got Mitch McConnell saying, hey, your party's left you. Why don't you come on over and become a Republican, they certainly would invite Manchin to change parties if he so chose to do that. But the thing to keep in mind here is that in a 50-50 Senate, Joe Manchin is effectively the Senate Majority Leader. He's been a Democrat all of his life. And in West Virginia, we know that the state has changed too. Donald Trump won West Virginia by 40%. So I think that Manchin, the big quote from this week is, "You can't really intimidate me. I'm from West Virginia." He's acting tough. I think that that plays well within his state. And I do think that the Build Back Better bill is dead for now, even though Chuck Schumer is going to force some votes to officially get everybody on the record in early 2022.
Looking at Joe Manchin and West Virginia and the possibility of his switching parties, the fact that the Democrats and the left have been beating him up so badly over this decision, which you can't argue, Scott, he's voting the view, the interests of his state, which is theoretically at least what an elected official should do. Are the Democrats really pushing him out of the party?
That's a good question. It does seem like, as some folks stay rooted in firm positions where they've always been ideologically, whether you're a blue dog moderate Democrat, the Democratic Party overall is taking this leftward lunge towards socialism in America. And that's what I think is being rejected by Joe Manchin. He has ultimately supported 90% of the policies that Democrats want to see enacted. But when it comes to a massive package that touches on nearly every element of the U.S. economy, of course, Manchin is going to have different viewpoint than the leftward lunge of socialists like Bernie Sanders and other hardball liberals like Liz Warren and Jeff Merkley. And I think that's what played out this week in the United States Senate.
The impact of all this on the elections is something that we are going to be talking about next week as we take a look at the key U.S. Senate and House of Representative races that will be taking place in 2022. But for now, we have been talking, as we typically do each week, and as we start another year, with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., If your listeners want to check us out and learn more about how our membership is united in economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity, check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Even government can't mess up something as simple as parking, can it? Well, yes, it can, as Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine finds out from Tory Clark of the Institute for Justice.
Anyone who wants to open a business, of course, has to jump through all sorts of hoops created by the government. Some of these make sense. You have to have inspections, health and safety issues have to be checked out, of course. But even after you clear those hurdles, local governments in many parts of this country could shut you down even for something as simple as not having enough parking spaces out in front of your business. And that's exactly what happened to the owner of a car repair shop in Texas. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Merry Christmas to you and your loved ones. But today we're taking a close look at the government grinches in Pasadena, Texas, who have told, as I said, the owner of a car repair shop there that he cannot open his business because he doesn't meet the city's arbitrary level of mandatory parking. He has to have 28 parking spaces for a business that he says simply doesn't need that much space. He doesn't ever have that many customers. But he is now fighting back with the help of the Institute for Justice. We are big fans of IJ over at Reason Magazine. I've had several people from IJ on the program here before, but we welcome to the show for the first time Tori Clark. She is an attorney with the Institute for Justice, and she joins us now to talk about this case that they have just launched. Tori, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about, is it Azael Sepulveda here, who is the client in this case, and he's run this mechanic shop in Pasadena, Texas for years, but now what the city is telling him, he's got to find additional parking or something like that for a business that he's had for a long time.
Yeah. So Azael has been running his own auto repair shop in Pasadena, Texas for almost a decade. And, you know, he also has his own YouTube channel called Oz Mechanics, OZ Mechanics, where he demonstrates for free how to make car repairs. Everyone loves his business. He gets great reviews on Google. And he has thousands of followers on YouTube that watch him make these car repairs. Asael and his wife are expecting their first child, so Asael has been wanting to invest further in his business. He's been working out of a leased location for years, but earlier this year, he finally bought his own shop, also in Pasadena. But when Asael asked the city for permission to open the new location, the city said no because Asael wasn't in compliance with the city's parking requirements.
So the parking requirement is, and you have to fill me in on the specifics here, but the parking requirement is for any business, except in this case, obviously he's not going to have more parking than he can, than the number of cars that he's going to be working on in a given day.
Well, so that would make a lot of sense if the parking requirements worked that way, but unfortunately they don't. The city has requirements for lots of different kinds of businesses that sets the minimum number of parking spaces that are required, specifically outdoor parking spaces. Asael averages about two customer cars outside of his shop at any given time. So the new shop currently has 5 spots, which he thought would be, more than sufficient. But the city, under the parking requirements, is demanding that Asael provide 28 total parking spaces before he can open his shop. And also, in general, these parking requirements, a lot of cities have them, but there's really not a whole lot of science behind it. It's not like an expert is coming in and saying, I've calculated and this is an actual number of parking spaces that they need. It really is kind of arbitrary.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, and this is, I think, the important part to this is that the, cities everywhere have these sorts of rules, and you can understand on one hand that the idea here is that they don't want cars backed up on, like, residential streets, right? Somebody who lives near a place like an auto repair shop, I guess, has some sort of interest in making sure that business isn't taking advantage of, like, the public resources. But on the other hand, this is dictating to a private business, to a private property owner, and in this case, in what seems like a really oppressive way, telling them what they have to provide, and maybe even more than what they would have to provide just to continue to operate their business. What's the legal issue here? Is that really the crux of it? Is there a constitutional issue here that I'm missing? What's the legal issue that you guys are taking to the courts?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. We are bringing a few different kinds of claims. The first, we're bringing a claim based on a case that IJ won in 2015 called Patel. And under that case, the Texas Supreme Court has said essentially that governments cannot regulate economic activity in irrational ways. So here we're saying that the parking requirement is regulating Asael's activity, his ability to run his business and also his, economic activities on his property. And because that regulation is irrational, it's unconstitutional. We're also bringing an equal protection claim. So we are looking at the city's other requirements for similar businesses where customers have to drive to locations to use that business, like, for instance, banks or, even like auto dealers. And the city's requirements for those businesses are much, much less than the requirements for auto repair shops. When a government treats two similar entities differently, it has to have a good reason. And so far, we have not heard any good reason from the city for why auto repair shops are treated differently. And finally, I haven't touched on this yet, but the city does have a process for asking for an exception from these parking requirements, but that process has to be fair. And Asael has tried to follow that process. He, filed his application. Us as his attorneys have followed up with the city several times, and he still has not gotten an answer, a yes or no, on whether he can have an exception to these requirements. So we're bringing what we call a procedural due process claim based on that, saying that the city's process in the exception process is not fair.
Yeah, it seems like he's followed all the right steps, and yet the city tells him no anyway. Again, that's Tori Clark from the Institute for Justice. Check out their work online at ij.org. Tori, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And that is Tori Clark. She's an attorney with the Institute for Justice. You can check out more of their fine work and a lot of different subject areas at ij.org. You can find more about this case up there as well. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage of what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the country at reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
You don't need to buy turtle doves or 5 golden rings. But Christmas is not a one-day event, rather it is a 12-day season. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Post-Christmas depression is a real thing. For many, it hits on December 26. In fact, sadly, for much of our culture, Christmas is over on that day. The ending can feel so painfully abrupt. After weeks and months of buildup, starting around Thanksgiving or even right after Halloween in our stores, it finally ends on December 26. You notice it on your radio. The wonderfully uplifting sounds of Christmas tunes all of a sudden vanish on December 26. But if that depresses you, well, I have good news. A historical newsflash, if you will. The culture is dead wrong. You need not be down in the dumps. The reality is that Christmas only just begins on December 25th. That day doesn't signal the end. It actually signals the start. If you need a song to remind you, don't croon Blue Christmas with Elvis. Hum the 12 Days of Christmas. Yeah, remember that one? It has the virtue of not merely some catchy rhymes, but historical accuracy. Christmas is a season. For most Western Christians, the season starts with Advent and then reaches its glory on December 25th and runs 12 days. Even Wikipedia gets it right. Quote, Christmas is an annual festival commemorating the birth of Jesus Christ, observed primarily on December 25th, a feast central to the Christian liturgical year. It is preceded by the season of Advent or the Nativity Fast, which in the West lasts 12 days. Unquote. Hallelujah for Wikipedia. If Wikipedia can get it right down to the term liturgical year, can't we? Needless to say, this is another manifestation of our rising post-Christian culture. The number of Christians and people who believe in God generally continues to plummet. The sociologist Peter Berger once said that the two most religious countries in the world are the United States and India. Well, that's falling fast. Hilaire Belloc once famously observed that the faith is Europe and Europe is the faith. Not anymore. In the United States, the fastest growing category recorded by pollsters asking about religious affiliation are the so-called nuns. It all adds up, doesn't it? There's a rising number of nuns, of atheists, of secular people, and of people not educated about things religious. That corresponds to a rising number of individuals for whom Christmas is a purely secular holiday that starts and ends December 25th. In turn, there's a corresponding rise in people feeling depressed immediately after Christmas Day. Websites like Psych Central and WebMD offer tips on how to cope with post-Christmas depression. It need not be. In fact, if I may end on a positive note of, yes, Christmas hope. Recall the poignant closing scene in A Charlie Brown Christmas. Charlie Brown laments that the holidays always depress him. In anguish, he cries out, "Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?" Linus steps forward. "Sure, Charlie Brown, I could tell you what Christmas is all about." Linus then recites the nativity narrative from Luke, chapter 2. "Fear not. For behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all my people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord." Linus sums up, "That's what Christmas is all about." You tell him, Linus. Merry Christmas, everyone. Fear not, take heart, it isn't ending. Don't be depressed, it's just starting. And its true meaning ought to give you hope all year round. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCEA-FM in Redwood City, California, along with KION-AM and FM in Salinas, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.